You're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 241, entitled, How to Build a Life of Resiliency and Live Life to the Fullest No Matter What Comes Your Way, I chat with Jim Stavis. Jim Stavis is an author, speaker, CEO, and triple organ transplant survivor. In today's episode, Jim talks about how to live life on your terms despite what others tell you and despite whatever challenges come your way. He shares his story of being diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at an early age and how he overcame a crippling diagnosis from doctors who told him he wouldn't live past the age of 50. Jim talks about his mindset, his perseverance, his determination, and his commitment to live life to the fullest despite his many health challenges, which included a triple organ transplant of the heart, kidney, and pancreas. If you're wondering how to live an untethered life in which you do all the things you want to do, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. If you want to get more content, more information, and extra bonuses I don't post anywhere else, make sure you follow me on Instagram right now. It's at Justin Stenstrom. That's JustinStenstrom. I'm posting pretty much every day throughout the week, most days out of the week for sure, but almost every day. And it's all kinds of information regarding health, wealth, business, life, dating, relationships, confidence, and so much more. I'm telling you, you're going to love seeing some of the stories I post about and the feed posts I post all the time. It's pretty interesting. It's pretty fun. I'm loving Instagram right now. So make sure you follow me, Instagram.com/Justin Stenstrom, or just jump on your phone right now, pull up the Instagram app, and it's at Justin Stenstrom. If you haven't checked out our YouTube channel yet, there's two reasons why. A, you're probably living under a rock and you haven't listened to any other Elite Man podcasts in the past. Or B, you're completely insane and you've just ignored all the messages that I've told you to check them out in the past. Either way, make sure you check it out right now. This is your last chance if you have not checked it out yet. And if it's been a while since you've checked some of our videos out, make sure you go back on and check them out today. I'm telling you, you are going to love some of our new videos. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube. And check them out today. Make sure you like some of the videos if you like them. Comment on some of the videos to leave your feedback and subscribe to our channel if you have not subscribed yet. And also, if you want to be super helpful and go one step further as an elite man, share some of our videos on your social media with some of your friends. I really do appreciate it personally, and I know my team does as well. We're trying to grow this as much as possible, so spreading that message with some of your friends who can benefit from watching these videos is one of the best things you can do for them and also for us. Again, go to elitemanmagazine.com/YouTube and check our channel out. You are going to love it. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from Elite Man Magazine. And my guest today is Jim Stavis, the CEO and president of Paragon Steel and also an author and speaker. Jim, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Justin, it's my pleasure.
Jim, I wanted to bring you on the show today because you have a very interesting story. There's so many different things in your life that you've done, you've overcome, the adversity that you've faced, the resilience you've built up over the years. You've written books on the subject, and you just have an incredible story that I think can resonate with so many people facing some type of adversity. What is, and by the way, you are the first person, I believe, ever to survive a triple organ transplant. Is that correct?
Of the sequence of organs that I have. That's correct. There have been other multiple organs, but never the sequence that I had, which was a heart, kidney, pancreas, which we'll get into.
Yeah. So what, we'll get into that for sure. But when you were younger, basically your doctor tells you at like age 17 or so that you're not going to live past age 50. You're currently, I think, 65 right now. What was it at age 17, and even before that, leading up to that point, that made you so sick, that made your doctors think this way, that made you have to face this type of adversity at such a young age?
I was diagnosed with juvenile type 1 diabetes, which back in the early 1970s, it was not nearly as common as it is today. And back then, the prevalence of diabetes would cause a shorter lifespan and problems such as kidney and heart disease, blindness, amputations. a lot of really horrible and scary side effects that were told to me by the doctors at that time, which was a pretty obviously dire diagnosis for a 17-year-old to have to absorb. And what it did for me is it forced me to make some decisions in my life in terms of how to approach a shortened lifespan. And I could have let it just depress me and prevent me from attaining life goals, et cetera. But I used it as more of a motivator so that I could start a business at a very young age, start a family. I went to college, got through UCLA. While a lot of my friends were having more fun and kind of letting their lives unfold, I had to take a life a little more seriously.
So how was that like growing up at a younger age, even say like you're 7, 8, 9, 10 years old and, you know, kids are playing Little League, they're running around having fun, they're just living life carefree. Did you have to deal with those things at a younger age too? And if so, how did that affect you even early on?
It really did not affect me until I was 17.
Okay, so it started kicking around then.
I had a normal life growing up in the LA area, you know, lots of friends, active in school and sports and whatnot. But this thing kind of hit me like a ton of bricks as I was just had gotten my driver's license a few months before.
Wow.
And then the next thing I'm having this conversation with a doctor with the gloomy forecast.
Yeah. So what are your first thoughts? What are your first impressions when you start to have to go through these symptoms, these problems that you're having? And then of course, when the doctor lays it on you that, you know, you have a serious condition here, you're probably not going to live past age 50 years old. What's your initial reaction to all that?
Well, there's a lot of shock, obviously. And I think that I was kind of at an age where I wasn't really a boy, a young boy, but I wasn't really a man either. So I was kind of in that stage where I was still living with my parents and I looked to them to kind of give me a little bit of, you know, taking their temperature on this whole thing. And they were kind of freaking out, to be honest with you. They were looking at each other, trying to figure out where this disease could have come from. Was it one side? Was it the other? And I looked at them like, it really doesn't matter. It is. And I'm the one that's going to have to deal with it. So in some ways it forced me to grow up faster than I perhaps would have.
Yeah. So are your parents basically, are they helping you by thinking that way, by, you know, by kind of panicking and having those thoughts or is that actually hurting?
I think that hurt me more than helped me. And I'm certainly not putting any blame on them, but I think that their generation was such that you kind of hid from problems rather than today. If you have a child with a problem, everybody knows about it. It's not something you hide. It's almost something that you promote. But the mentality of my parents was more like, let's try and not let anybody know what their son is going through, because they didn't think that was good. It almost was like it wasn't good PR. So, yeah. It was kind of a negative thing. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. What is, I want to dive into some more of the story in a moment, but kind of off topic, do you think it's important for people nowadays to actually talk about the problems that they're facing, if it's something like, you know, type 1 diabetes or cancer or whatever, you know, kind of secret illness that befalls someone that, you know, historically, like you said, in the past, most people would try to kind of hide or not really, you know, talk about with their friends or family or neighbors, people at school, coworkers. Do you think it's actually healthy in your view to express this and let people know what you're going through?
I think that I'm somewhat of a product of my generation, which was probably more expressing it than, let's say, my parents' generation were. But today, with, let's say, millennials, and I don't know how much of your audience is millennials, because of social media, people will go out and, you know, be very, very expressive and reflect whatever it is that they're going through. I have some friends of ours, their son is going through some cancer right now. And they actually have like an active blog with telling every little moment by moment stage that their son is going through, which is so different than, let's say, what my parents did.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm just wondering too. I mean, it just begs the question, is that a good approach? And maybe for every person, it's different too. Maybe some people actually would do better with, say, your parents' approach of just kind of keeping that indoors because they're not a very expressive person, or they're maybe, you know, a reserved type of person. They don't like to share things. But for other people who, say, are more outgoing or more extroverted, and, you know, they get hit with something crazy like this, a crazy, you know, cancer diagnosis or something, maybe for them actually expressing on social media and having a blog and talking about it all the time, it's actually healthier for them to do that. I wonder. It's just kind of a, you know, an interesting question.
I think it's a sign of the times is the reality. I think that people are much more so, as you've just described today, than they were, let's say, way back when I was 17 years old and I was encountering my problem. And so that the way that my parents handled it certainly is not how I would handle it today. And I would certainly wouldn't hide from it, because I think that what that does is it creates denial. And if you deny that you've got a problem, you're not helping yourself. You're not doing yourself any favors at all.
So what would you do if you got this diagnosis at 17 in 2019 or 2020?
I think that I would certainly become as educated as I could be in terms of what the best forms of treatment would be, what the best doctors that I would go and see. I don't know that I would be one that would be posting it on Facebook or Instagram, but I think that I would use technology and the internet to educate myself. And today you have so many more tools available to you than what we had back in the early 1970s. And I think it's important to note, Justin, just so your audience, if you are diabetic or you know someone that's diabetic, family member, friend, et cetera, your fate today is wholly different than it was 35, 40 years ago when I was diagnosed, because the maintenance, the care, the technology, everything has changed. Even the foods that we eat today, there are available and sugar-free options that I didn't have when I was growing up. So it's a different animal today than it was back then.
Yeah, that's a good point to make too, for sure. We cover health topics like that all the time. And you know, you're living proof that obviously this thing is very beatable, and you can lead such a great life with or without a disease like diabetes type 1 or type 2 for that matter. It's, I believe type 2 actually to be a lot easier to reverse in my experience though. But, you know, I'm not too sure with type 1, but I know obviously with guys like you leading a completely normal life that, you know, it's not that crazy death sentence that it used to be 20, 30, 40 years
That's
ago.
Correct.
And, you know,
that's correct.
It's so good to have that fear removed at least. Jim, going back to you at 17, way back then, when you get this diagnosis and your doctor basically tells you, you know, you're going to have to do all these crazy changes, your life's never going to be the same, you're going to die by 50, and then your parents are kind of freaking out and they're panicking as well. What about you at 17 years old? Because most people probably would have just threw in the towel or at least given up all kinds of hope and, you know, the thought that they can overcome this. What was it inside you back then that actually made you believe that you were going to be fine and still gave you the hope to continue fighting?
I think two main things. One is that I'm an optimistic person. I believe basically in that good things will happen to me, and if they were meant to happen, they will happen. So in some ways, I'm kind of fatalistic as well. And so I put my faith in medical technology, which looking at it today, it surprises me that I was so adept at back then to think that like I had some positive hopes that technology would have the cure for diabetes, which we don't yet, but we're getting very close to it now. And at the same time, little did I think that there would be a transplant option waiting for me so many years down the line. But it turned out that I was right. I mean, as kind of as wacky as it may have sounded back then, it turned out to be the winning solution for me.
So did you just always have this hope inside you that even when everyone was basically telling you you're screwed and that, you know, it's not going to be good, the outlook doesn't look good for you, the forecast doesn't look bright. Did you just have that hope inside you somewhere that because you were an optimistic person and that hope is what led you to keep doing it? Like, what is the power of hope? I know you've talked about this in the past of like having a little bit of hope, but did you have that hope inside you? And if so, how helpful was it to actually have that belief that you could do it?
I think in some ways we're all kind of hardwired to be either optimistic or pessimistic. I mean, it's how we look at the world. And some people that I've certainly have encountered in my life are very negative about everything. And yet my attitude has always been one where I just look at things like that things are going to be okay, and that there's a positive way of looking at things versus a negative way. And I have always chosen the positive way. So I think the reason I say that it's hardwired is because I've been around people that have been confronted by much less adversity and have just shrunk when confronted by hardship. And other people like myself have kind of risen above it. And it's hard to preach to somebody about how to be something that you're not. So if you're a negative person, how does a positive person influence that negativity from going away? It's a hard thing to do.
Yeah. So when you decide back then that you're not going to give in, you're not going to throw in the towel, you're not gonna just going to be apathetic and, you know, withdraw from life, what are some of the steps that you take to continue to try to be normal? And what are some of the things that you do to make sure that you're actually feeling at your best, despite having this in the background, like a dark cloud in the background that's always following you around? How do you get past that dark cloud?
You focus on the positive, you focus on your life, and you just move forward. I mean, the reality is if you don't let it cripple you and you just move forward, then, you know, life just kind of goes along its way. And you just have to have an attitude like, this diabetes is not going to define who I am and what I can do in life. I'm going to do my life while I have diabetes. So there's a pretty big distinction there, because I wasn't using the diabetes as kind of an excuse that I couldn't do anything. If anything, it was a motivator for me to kind of get my act together.
Were there any things that you couldn't do, like physically, or different events that you had to miss out on, or different things that you missed just because you did have the diabetes? And if so, like the limitations of, say, having type 1 diabetes at that age, and then, you know, because at that point in your life, you're basically, you're in the state of mind where you want to do everything and just experience everything and have so much fun all the time. Were there things that limited you? And if so, how did you get past that feeling of just, you know, being so down and not being able to do some of these things physically because you had this disease or condition?
Actually, this will sound strange, but it's actually to the contrary. I think that I took more risks as a young person because I felt like, why not?
Okay, you know, cool.
am I going to live a life of fear, or am I going to just go for it? And so I did a lot of kind of daredevilish things that I perhaps might not have done. Like, you know, we have a body surfing location out here that I nearly drowned it at, because there it's kind of a dangerous setting to body surf. And I flew in a small airplane up to a ski location here in Southern California. And that was probably an airplane that wasn't necessarily fit to fly, and worried that it might crash. And I would like scuba dive. I would just do more, I don't want to say it's daredevilish, but it's just, I had an attitude like, what have I got to lose? You know, So it, in some ways, it made me almost more daredevilish than I would have perhaps been.
Yeah, and it actually sounds like it was a blessing in disguise in some ways, where you actually did more in your life because of this, whereas before you probably would have been a little more reserved and a little less willing to try new things. But this is actually what kind of pushed you off the deep end, was like, you know what, screw it. I'm not going to wait home all day and do nothing because I have this. Let me actually just live life to the fullest.
That's correct. So, so in that regard, it made me a little less cautious and just kind of throwing caution to the wind. And I was fortunate that, you know, none of those activities that I did me in either.
Yeah. Did you ever have any setbacks along the way? Like at what age did you get the triple organ transplant? So at what age did you get that? And then from the time you got diagnosed at 17 to that age, were there any like setbacks with your health?
Well, I always had to manage the diabetes. And so what that means, I had to test my blood sugar multiple times a day. I had to take insulin shots multiple times a day. And then later would get an insulin pump, which is today's technology, that's pretty standard. But at the time that I was doing it, it was new, where it automatically, like a pancreas, injects or secretes insulin as needed. So the maintenance of the diabetes is kind of what is critical to make sure that your blood sugar levels don't get out of whack, which might cause a reaction. That's kind of the secret to diabetic management, is trying to stay on top of where you are and as far as your blood sugar ranges are concerned. And it's that, how well you do that is how you forestall the effects of it, the side effects of which I said was kidney disease, heart disease, all the blood vessels in your body are affected by it. So to answer your question, though, from the age of 17, really until my early 40s, I kind of lived a somewhat normal life. I mean, from the outside, you would not know that I was a diabetic. There was nothing, you know, outwardly different about me. And my, you know, I still played sports. I still traveled. You know, I had a family life, ran a business. So from the outside, it looked like it was a very normal life. And I didn't even share the fact that I was a diabetic with most people. But in my early 40s, I had an event. We were vacationing up in the mountains here in Southern California with my family. And we went on it's called a ropes course, which you're doing kind of paramilitary events, climbing trees, swinging on ropes. And it's a lot of adrenaline, and it was a pretty intense day. And at the end of the day, I was 20 feet in the air on a pole, and my heart stopped. And so fortunately, I had a circle of people below, and one of them was a childhood friend of mine who gave me CPR, and I was out for about a half hour. Wow. And finally... he revived me before, because there was no paramedics, there was no medical up there. So he revived me, and that was my first cardiac event, it turns out that one of the arteries was 95% blocked. So they brought me down the mountain, and it was the first of many cardiac surgeries that I would have to encounter through the years. So this happened in 1997, and ultimately the transplants occurred in 2005. So that was about 8 years before that.
Wow.
Just as I turned 50, ironically, because that was the magical expiration date that I had been given.
Wow. Yeah, that's crazy.
And just before I turned 50, my kidneys failed. You go into congestive heart failure. And so then I had to be on kidney dialysis, which was kind of a very negative time in my life. So here I am at age 49, going on 50. My kidneys aren't working. My heart is failing. And I went to Cedars-Sinai Hospital, and the chief of cardiology there, Dr. P.K. Shaw, says to me, well, you need a new heart, you need a new kidney, and best case, a new pancreas, which would rid you of your diabetes and preserve the other two organs. The problem is we've never done such a surgery. I don't know if it's ever been done. And I just kind of looked at him and said, well, then I'm going to be the first one, you know, like boldly. So, and it turns out that that's what happened. So I almost go back to that first doctor appointment back when I was 17, that my attitude back then kind of set the stage for my attitude when I was 50. Like, I wasn't going to allow this condition to end my life, because it just, my attitude was such that it just wasn't going to happen.
If you are not on the Elite Man newsletter yet, make sure you get on it right now. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter and sign yourself up today. Get all of our bonus podcast information, sneak peeks into upcoming shows, behind the scenes content, special offers, and exclusive Elite Man updates found absolutely nowhere else. You are basically getting a sneak peek into all Elite Man content, activity, and updates and news. You will be the first person notified when anything Elite Man related happens. I'm telling you, it's basically like getting a sneak peek into Elite Man headquarters. Go to elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter, sign yourself up, and become a true member of the Elite Man community. I look forward to speaking to you soon. elitemanmagazine.com/newsletter.
Yeah, I think it's the perfect attitude to have too when you face something like this in life, whether it's a health condition or just some other crazy adversity or challenge that comes your way. You gotta have belief in yourself, and you know, despite what everyone else is saying, when the experts or the doctors give up hope in you, you still have to have hope in yourself. And, you know, for whatever reason, Jim, it seems like you were kind of born with that, or you just had that from a young age and never left it. And if anything, it just kind of grew. So by the time it came around where you were 50 and you were having these problems again, it was like, you know, I've been dealing with this for 50 years. It's just, this is nothing right. new.
Bring it on.
Yeah. I'm interested with the time you said your heart stopped for 30 minutes. Does it basically mean that you were like declared dead for 30 minutes and you came back? Was it one of those things?
I was unconscious, but the heart was fibrillating. So it was in kind of a,
interesting.
You know, like it wasn't fully fully operative. Yeah, you know.
A purgatory so, state.
I mean, they say that often, usually when you have a cardiac event like I did, that it's usually sudden death. You don't get another chance. You know, it's like the first cardiac event is oftentimes your last cardiac event. And for me, what was so strange about that day, which was a very, you know, it's a day I'll never forget, 22 years ago now, I was, the prior day I was hiking by myself, and had it happened the prior day, there would have been nobody around to save me. And so I kind of looked at it once again, like sometimes things are just meant to happen the way that they are. And clearly somebody was looking after me.
Yeah.
So that when I had this event, there was a circle of friends and family around that could kind of bring me back, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah. Did that actually lead you afterwards into feeling like you always had to be around other people in case something like this happened again, say, you know, riding an elevator or something like that, where like, you know, if you get stuck in that thing for an hour and you have a heart attack, you know, you might not come out because no one's in there with you. Do you have thoughts like that or feelings like you have to be around other people now because that happened in the past?
That's a great question.
I don't want to jinx you or anything.
No. It's a great question. I used to joke because I golf, and I would say to my golf friends, you guys know CPR, right? Just in case something happens. And they go, no, we don't know CPR. So I think it's just a reality that I learned to live with.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't say that I was any more paranoid, but I think that the lesson in it for me was I needed to kind of take my health even more seriously. You know, I was a little you know, should I have been up on this ropes course doing adrenaline activities in the heat and then the altitude of the mountains? Probably not. But again, it was a sign that I wasn't going to allow my diabetes to dictate the way my life was going to be. I was going to rise above it. So that's the lesson.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the way you live your life is the best way to live life. And as far as like, even people who aren't facing some type of crazy adversity or challenge, you know, you have like, say, a terrorist attack or some kind of crazy like natural disaster or something. And you have people who from that point forward live their lives in fears. Like everything they do, everywhere they go, they're always thinking about the next terrorist attack or the next mass shooting or hurricane or tornado that just like killed a bunch of people in the past. And yeah, those things are incredibly dangerous and horrible. And, you know, it's a shame that those things have to actually happen in the life that we live. But the truth is, if we live our lives from that point forward, always worrying about them and fearing those things, and we can't actually enjoy life from that point forward. It ruins us before it ever even happened. It ruins us because it happened once, and the rest of our lives are then dictated because of that one incident.
That's correct. And I used to always preach to my kids that you never should worry about the stuff you have no control over, because otherwise you'll spend your whole life worrying. And I never elected to live that way.
Yeah. Jim, you talk about building bulletproof resilience. Is there like three steps or so that you talk about as far as like other people listening to take away from that they can actually build their own resilience from?
Well, I've kind of broken it down into three phases. The first phase, which is seemingly the most difficult, which is the endurance stage, which is you have to endure the adversity, the pain, the sorrow, the heartache, the loss, whatever it is. It's tough. It's, you know, especially if you have not been in a situation where you've been in a lot of pain or you've had loss. It's really a hard thing, and I don't want to diminish that at all. But unfortunately, you have to get through it. You just have to suck it up. And as the Nike ad says, just do it. And there's no way around that. But you have to have a belief that you can do it, that there's a way through it. And that comes into the second stage, which is really what I call the hope stage. And the hope stage is having the belief, the fortitude, the power of thought, and thinking of hope in kind of a, like it's a verb versus a noun, so that there's some action associated with it. What are you going to do? And you're not just sitting on the couch wishing you're going to get better, but actually take steps to ensure that you can kind of put your mind in a proper state of mind so that you can get through it to the next stage. And then the third stage is, once you've gotten through the adversity, you've kind of climbed the mountain and you have overcome whatever it is that is challenging you. And then what are you going to do then? How are you going to use this adversity to help yourself going forward, help others? And I consider myself in that stage right now, which is why I wrote a book and I speak about the subject, to try and help others go through their adversity.
That makes a lot of sense. And I love the fact, I love the, obviously the final step probably the best, because you're not just experiencing life and, you know, you're getting past it, which is cool and it's great. You're actually learning from your experiences, which is even better, and then applying it to either yourself, which, you know, we're always growing and learning in life, or even more importantly, to other people, where you can help more people, others who are going through the same or similar things that you've gone through and overcome yourself. And that's really one of the most important things in life, in my belief, is giving back to others and actually helping them grow from what you've learned in your past.
I agree. I'm right there with you.
And you say by doing this too, that other people, this is basically the recipe for building resilience, no matter what you're facing, you go through these three stages, and then at the end of it, you're going to, you know, be incredibly resilient.
Yeah. And what you find is that once you go through this process, the next time you're confronted with some kind of adversity, you knew that you could get through it the last time, and you'll know that you'll get it through it the next time. So it's almost like a muscle. The more you use it, the better you are for the next time that you're confronted with it. And in my case, because I was confronted with adversity at a relatively young age, that by the time I was, let's say, 50 years old later in my life, and I was given this daunting set of what I should be doing or what I could be doing, I could rely on the fact that I had gotten through all these other adversities prior in my past to help me going through them in the future.
Jim, did you have to deal with the death of a close business partner or a friend? And if so, how did this resiliency built up throughout your life of, say, 3 decades or so of going through the diabetes? How did that help you overcome that?
So I started my company with a partner in 1988, and he had been very close to me. We had developed kind of almost a brotherly relationship together. He was my age, and it was critical that while I was going through all of my medical stuff, he was able to kind of run the business in my absence, which was imperative for me. But, and he was a very healthy person, let's say, certainly by comparison to me. And then about 5 years ago, he had encountered something that he went to the hospital and got an infection while in the hospital. And unfortunately, the infection started to take its toll and spread throughout his body. And it was one of these super bugs that they just couldn't get their arms around. And he passed away. And for me, it was just a horrific time because I had been running the company with him for 25 years. And now suddenly I was, you know, kind of on my own. And I had tried to help him. The course of his infection was about 2 years. So from the time that he first got it to the time that he ultimately passed was 2 years. And I was trying to guide him through the process because he probably had, you know, what one of the best partners he could have in terms of understanding the body and the hospitals and doctors and everything else. So I was trying to encourage him and kind of guide him through the process. But like I said to you before, if you're not, your DNA is not such that you're hardwired to be positive, you can't make somebody that's negative positive. And he really was very defeated through the whole process. He could not get a positive orientation. And it was in some ways he kind of resigned himself that if he died, you know, God would take care of him in death or in life. And if he wasn't to survive, then it was meant to be. And I struggled with that because that was not how I viewed it at all. I was more where I was going to try and control my destiny rather than, let's say, put it in God's hands.
Yeah. So how did you get over that? Like, you have someone you're trying to help, and I've dealt with this too in the past with people that I've tried to help with different situations. And, you know, I think that I know the right answers or the solutions to some of their problems, but it's like, you know, the harder you try, the more you invest and the more you try to help them, sometimes they just don't take that advice or they don't want that help or they're just not going to listen for whatever reason. How did you actually resolve that with yourself? And, you know, after he died, how did you get over the fact that, you know, it was over and there's nothing you could have did about it?
It's still hard. It's still very frustrating for me because I felt like if I could have only gotten him to listen to me and follow what I was trying to, you know, I had him pretty much teed up and ready to go to the hospital, the Cedars-Sinai hospital, but I couldn't get him to leave the hospital that he was at, which unfortunately they had no solution to his problem. And really what I came to, Justin, is there's three things that I think are critical when you're going through something like this. One is you need to have the right attitude, the right mental state, as we've talked. And two is you need to have the best doctors and hospitals that can be championing your case. And the third thing is you need a support system with family and friends. And in all three of those areas, his situation was not as good as my situation was. So I saw those as big, glaring deficiencies as far as it related to him that contributed to his demise.
Yeah. It's you know, very unfortunate, obviously. And it really does suck when you know you have like great advice or great information or solutions that can help someone, especially someone you love, someone that's so close to you, and they just, for whatever reason, can't take that. And it, you know, it's just something that I think with time you kind of get over, or you kind of not really get over it, but you realize that there's some things that you just can't control in your life. And that's one correct. Of them, you know,
my cardiologist ultimately sat me down and told me to stop beating myself up.
Yeah.
Because you never know. He could have died anyway. He could have gone to the hospital that you told him to go to. He could have had the best care, the best doctors, and there's no guarantees. So my cardiologist kind of told me to get over it.
Yeah. And it's tough too. It takes time to really get over something like that. Maybe you never fully do, but at least you can like get past it enough to be normal and, you know, happy again. But yeah, man, I'm sorry for that, because that is a tough thing. And I know how tough that can be personally. But do you have a secret like recipe or process for making tough life decisions, Jim? It says here that you actually come up with this type of formula that when you're facing different circumstances or different problems in your life, you have this kind of process that you go through.
I do. And it starts really with it, trying to face facts head on, in that, you know, it doesn't do yourself any favors to pretend that, let's say, or be in denial of the problem that you have, because the first step is really being able to kind of look in the mirror and realize that it is what it is, and what am I going to do about it? So then the next stage really is trying to educate yourself on what those options are. What does that look like? What, you know, in my case, I went to probably 4 or 5 hospitals and doctors because my situation was pretty unique. And I was getting a variance of opinions. It wasn't as if everybody said, yep, this is what you should do. You need a triple organ transplant. So for me, it was kind of a case. I had one doctor that said, well, you're diabetic, you know, we do the best we can with what you've got, but it is what it is. And I felt like, well, that's not a solution for me. So I kind of felt like I needed to find a doctor who would be more progressive in their approach and believing that they could find a solution to my problem. And ultimately I found a doctor who was not affiliated with any of the large medical centers. And he said to me, how do you feel about transplant? And I said, transplant? I had no idea. And he says, yeah. He says, I have transplant patients that I can't even get them to come back to my office. They're doing so well. So I started to think about that. And then from there, I started interviewing transplant centers until I found Cedars-Sinai and had the conversation with Dr. Shaw. And that ended up to be the winning formula for me. So I think that you have to be willing to face facts. You have to be willing to do the legwork to find solutions. And then ultimately, when you find the solution, you need to be willing to take decisive steps and go for it. You know, you don't want to second guess yourself along the way. You want to kind of take decisive action. It's kind of like running a company, to be honest with you. A lot of the skills that I felt like I was using in my personal life, I also use in my business life. So, you know, you have to, the only difference is in your personal life, if you make the wrong decision, it can cost you your life. In business, you can kind of course correct. If you make a wrong decision, well, then let's go this way. So the stakes are greater when you're dealing with your health.
Yeah. And I think you're so right about that too. It totally applies right into business. And you guys have been real successful too at, what is it? Paragon Steel. What are some of the numbers that you've done? Like 25 million in revenue or something like that?
That's our sales volume.
Wow. And, that's awesome.
We're mostly distribution. Before, we had a fabrication division, but when my partner died, I sold the fab division and just run the distribution center now.
Awesome, man. Yeah. I mean, so dude, you're just living proof of, you know, what this type of mindset can do. And, you know, when you're hit with adversity, whether it's a health thing or some other type of crisis in life, it's just the way you look at it, the way you choose to look at it. And then from that point forward, the way you choose to live your life. And you, like you did, Jim, you didn't hold anything back. You just kept going forward, man. And, you know, from one health challenge that you overcame to the next. And then of course the business, all the success with that, man, it's truly an inspiration. And I really appreciate you coming on the show, man. What is the last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience? And then a place that our listeners can check out more about your work.
Well, I can't leave you without telling your audience to become organ, say yes to organ donation, because it really does save lives. And there's currently about 120,000 people waiting for life-saving organs across the country. So
nice.
That's number one. Number two message is, if you're diabetic, you know, don't freak out. You're not going to necessarily be a triple organ recipient. Your life can be totally normal. So that we said earlier, but I think it's worth pointing out once again.
Yep.
And then the third thing really is just try and have hope within your life. And the other thing that I find that's really powerful is to be gracious in your life and just feel lucky for the things that you've got, because gratitude is one of those things that, you know, you can never have enough of. So that would be my last send off to you.
Love it, man. Jim, thanks again for coming on. Oh wait, what's the website, the link to check out more about your work and your book?
The name of the book again is When Hope Is Your Only Option. And it's kind of it's not just about my story, but it's how to help the reader get through difficult times. And it's available to all the, you know, Amazon, Barnes and Noble. And I even did an Audible version in my voice that's available. My website is jimstavis.com. And if you wanted to follow my blogs and whatnot, I have a Jim Stavis Speaks on Facebook.
Awesome. Jim, thanks again for coming on, man. Really do appreciate it. And take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, Justin. Thank you.
All right, guys. I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I'd like you to do, and that's this. Subscribe to our podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast episodes and all of our world-class advice absolutely free. Subscribe now if you haven't already and become an Elite Man today. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an amazing review. We really do appreciate it.